Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 20th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Ann Wood at the Provincetown Banner and Mike Roush at the Bourne Enterprise. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the island. Cindy, let's start this morning with the ongoing discussion around recreational marijuana. This was legalized officially in December, but many communities still trying to figure out what to do about allowing or banning the sale of recreational marijuana in their towns. Mashpee voters weighed in on this issue at town meeting Monday night. And seems like they fell into line with a number of other towns on the Cape.
Yeah, the voters overwhelmingly approved a temporary moratorium that would prohibit recreational marijuana establishments from opening. And this moratorium will go until the end of December 2018. And the vote was 219 to 95. And then Mashpee has joined Bourne, Harwich, Orleans, and Yarmouth, which have all passed temporary moratoriums as they wait for these. They're looking to review these regulations that are being established by the state's fledgling Cannabis Control Commission.
Mm-hmm. So, and in some ways, what they're doing is just kind of buying some time here, right? They're kicking it down the road a little bit.
Exactly. Putting it off a little bit into the future. And it's interesting because one of the things the Edward Larkin, who stood in for the town moderator, said that he said there was not going to be a discussion on the pros and cons of recreational marijuana, only a discussion about the moratorium. They're just going to stick to that. And he also limited the number of people who could speak on the issue, which prompted some boos. But yeah. The vote actually, then there was the vote that approved this moratorium.
Well, a lot of people want to step up and talk about this, I know. Another thing that they did mention at the town meeting that night was also pickleball. And that they voted to approve some funding for pickleball courts.
Yeah, pickleball is very big. It's Mashpee has a lot of retirees, and this is a sport that's big among retirees now. And voters approve spending up to $420,000 in community preservation funds to construct pickleball courts. And they're still concerned about where they're going to be located. The preferred location would be a Route 130 parcel near Mashpee Town Hall that hosts the town's community gardens. Another location that has been discussed is on the Schumet Road adjacent to the Mashpee Dog Park.
Hmm. Okay, I want to go to Dennistown meeting then, which was also taking care of business, and they were also addressing the marijuana issue, among other issues.
Yeah, they actually approved a measure banning recreational marijuana establishments from setting up shop in town, and this is a special town meeting, and they had actually banned the recreational marijuana in a May election, but they revisited the issue because of new state legislation that set new rules for towns prohibiting the establishments. The new rules set by the legislature say that towns with majority of voters who voted no on question four during the 2016 election could adopt an ordinance or bylaw prohibiting these establishments in a town meeting vote as long as it takes place before mm-hmm. the end of 2019. Again, this was people were very much opposed to having these recreational marijuana shops, at least for now. Well, this is a ban. And the vote was 284 to 61 approving the ban.
That's a very clear decision, 284 to 61.
Right. It's the second time the voters there have spoken. And this does not affect medical marijuana.
Oh, that's right. All of this is only just about recreational marijuana
establishments. That's right.
And a very specific ban. In the end, they're prohibiting marijuana manufacturers, marijuana retailers, or any other type of licensed marijuana-related businesses in town. They really broke it down.
Yeah. Marijuana cultivators, independent testing laboratories, marijuana product manufacturers, marijuana retailers, or any type of licensed marijuana-related businesses in town. Again, recreational.
The other thing they did take care of at that same town meeting was some new hires for firefighters. I saw that they were going to allocate some money for a number of new firefighters.
Yeah, the town will receive $1.3 million over the next 3 years through a SAFER grant to help pay the salaries of firefighters in the future. And said that, and the Dennis Fire Chief Mark Delner said he's, pleased the town has always supported its fire department.
Cindy, you reported a story this week about the MCAS exams. This year, students across the state had to take a new standardized test. It's what's called, I guess, the next generation MCAS. The results have come in, and it Turns out this test was a little bit harder, huh?
Yeah, well, the test is supposed to be harder. It's supposed to be more rigorous, involve more critical thinking, and it's also a new test, and students are taking it mainly on the computer, and getting up to speed on that is an issue. It's called Next Gen MCAS, and you may recall that, you know, the Park, many schools took the Park test, this national test, for a couple years, and there was a lot of controversy about that. And then the state came up with this Next Gen MCAS test that's mm-hmm. supposed to sort of be a blend of what they're now calling a legacy MCAS, which 10th graders still took, and 10th graders have to pass that to graduate from high school. But the Next Gen test was grades 3 through 8 in English, language, arts, and math. And like students in the Cape, I mean, some of the results were, you know, up and down, like some districts had really good results in one area, mm-hmm. really bad results. But for the most part, they sort of mirrored the state, where fewer than half of, just under half or just about half the students either met or exceeded expectations. And that's the new standard.
So explain the standards for us, because there's a couple of them that go along.
Yeah, there's exceeding expectations, meeting expectations, partially meeting expectations, and then not meeting expectations. And that's new. And that's whereas you might recall the legacy MCAS, where, you know, if you were advanced proficient and students have to be, the 10th graders now have to be proficient in order to graduate from high school, which is meaning they have to have a score of at least 240. Now, 10th graders, the current year's 9th graders may have a little bit of a shock, because they took the Next Gen MCAS this spring as 8th graders. And so their testing scores may be concerning to them, because they'll probably be lower than what they saw on the previous MCAS. And the parents might be concerned also. The state officials actually are sending out the results next week to the parents, and they are including a letter saying your child will not be penalized or held accountable for these scores in the 3 through 8 grade range on Next Gen. But this year's 9th graders will also be, as 10th graders, will be the first class to take the first class of 10th graders to take Next Gen to graduate. Again, there's a lot of fear and trepidation about this, but the state said it is going to lower the bar for the passing grade for a few years in order to get, you know, schools and students time to get up to speed on this new test.
So there was some question you mentioned about the number of children you have to take this test on computers, and whether this has affected the outcome for a number of children.
Well, the Mashpee School Superintendent Patricia DeBoer actually brought that up, and she said that she wonders if taking the test on computers is negatively impacting students' performance, especially on the open-ended responses. Now, Mashpee did pretty well, and in many cases did better than the state average, but the superintendent was pointing out that the average score across the state wasn't all that great. You know, what's going on here? And they said that they will be taking a very close look at this. And there are people who are still opposed to the new test.
I wanted to bring this up, yes.
Yes, it is. Citizens for Public Schools says these newer, harder tests will just widen test score gaps. It said a 2015 study that was actually ordered by Massachusetts Education Secretary James Pazer said neither the legacy MCAS nor the PARC is an accurate predictor of college readiness.
And so they wonder why the students are being subjected to these tests if they're not the accurate predictor that they're supposed to be.
Yeah, they're saying that there's going to be a lot of time devoted to the test, you know what I mean? And
yes.
and it's not going to be an accurate predictor, because that is the big concern. You know, are students ready for college? Because a large number of students, you know, go on to college and still need remedial courses, especially in math, they say.
A new workforce study out points that that retiring baby boomers are going to leave a vacancy in the workforce, which could be met by tech school graduates. This comes, of course, as 12 towns on the Cape get ready to go to the polls on Tuesday to vote whether to support building a new Cape Cod Regional Technical High School. Tell us a little about this.
Yeah, this will be a $128 million new construction project for Cape Tech, and the 12 towns are preparing to vote on October 24th. And this recent workforce study considers the retirement of baby boomers through 2022. It shows that the region will have many job openings for those with less than with a bachelor's degree. Through 2022, there will be 1,083 openings in the Cape and Islands requiring only a high school education, and another 1,226 openings requiring up to an associate's degree. This is according to Meeting the Commonwealth's Workforce Needs, a 2015 study by Northeastern University, which is done in conjunction with the Massachusetts School Building Authority. And so they say that, you know, these graduates from these vocational and technical schools in the Cape could fill up to 20% of these openings.
It's a nice article that really pulls out and it talks to a number of students who went through it and people who came out of the school and talks about their experience and how strong it was in preparing them for the workplace.
Yeah, one young woman, Courtney Howes of Chatham, said that she was failing in school and she really needed that that sort of hands-on type of learning that inspired her to learn. I mean, she needed to have like an end in sight for her future, and that's why Cape Tech worked so well for her. Someone else who was interviewed was saying, you know, went on to college. He was Alan Sharp, and he went because he ended up studying sports management at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. But his mom was, you know, really wanted him to learn a trade. So he studied boat engine repair at Cape Tech. And he said, I didn't hate it, but I knew I wasn't good at it. So, you know, it really works for some people and not for others. It's a really individual thing.
Well, it gives you a real opportunity to find out whether that is going to be the thing for you, too.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
You know, we have so many stories about the opioid epidemic, and your reporter, Casey Myers, has been continuing some excellent work on her coverage of the opioid epidemic. And she has one story about the overdose toll on just one October weekend and the police saying that they don't know what to do, that they can't arrest their way out of this situation. It has to be a bigger solution.
Yeah, well, yes, Casey met with, she interviewed police chiefs from Falmouth and higher up police officers or administrators from Falmouth, Sandwich, Yarmouth, and Barnstable, and had some shocking statistics. Now, it's interesting because Cape police have taken down entire drug organizations on the Cape, like the Naughty Block Gang. But overdoses in the Cape's three largest towns this year have already exceeded the total for 2016. Mm. And, you know, fingers are being pointed at fentanyl, of course. That's the opioid made in labs. That's 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine. In August, state police took down the Cape's biggest dealers, Alex and Kevin Frog of Yarmouthport. They took them off the streets. The next weekend, 18 people overdosed on the Cape. And that's according to Sandwich Police Chief Peter Wack. So when they took these dealers off the street, they seized a large amount of drugs too. So, but it's still out there, and so the numbers are pretty astounding, and they seem to be getting worse by the second. 41 people overdosed in Barnstable in August, compared to 13 in July. And some of the stories told by the police were just sort of boggle the mind and show the powerful pull of these opioids. There were four overdoses Columbus Day weekend in Barnstable, two fatal, but one of the fascinating things was one of the fatalities occurred about 24 hours after the victim had been revived after overdosing at McDonald's by Exit 5 in Plymouth. The 35-year-old man told people in the ER in Plymouth that he had to rush home to take care of his son, which wasn't true because he doesn't have custody of his son. But he actually ran home to Bursa's Way in Hyannis and took a fatal dose of fentanyl. He was found dead by his mother.
We're going to talk a little bit more about this epidemic in the program and some of the coverage. It's just the numbers are boggling as you hear about the numbers of overdoses in a single weekend right now that the police are dealing with. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, it's Cindy McCormick. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we're going to hear from Tim Wood, and we'll have more just in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And joining us on the phone right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hiya, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, Harwich is considering renovating the fire station in East Harwich, but now it looks like they might replace it instead. Tell us about this.
Indeed, yeah. After hearing this week from their consultant, the building committee that was charged with looking into renovating and rehabilitating the 41-year-old station in East Harwich, which is on the corner of Routes 137 and 39, voted to instead pursue construction of a new building on the same site. What they found was that the cost would be approximately the same, in fact, a little less to build a new building. It had cost about $6.5 million for additions and renovations to bring the current building up to health, safety, and building codes. But the construction of a new building, about 1,000 square feet, about the same size as the existing one, would be about $66.2 million, and that would take care of all those health and safety and building code issues because it would be a brand-new building. Now, both of these cost estimates are much higher than the $4 million figure that was put forth in May when the building committee received $310,000 from town meeting to begin designing and bidding this project. But that smaller amount wouldn't have addressed all of the building's shortfalls, according to the architects for the project. The new building would address those shortfalls, and construction building that new building on available land on the same parcel would allow the existing station to continue to function while a new one is built, which of course saves even more money because you wouldn't have to relocate that station's functions for the building period. Now, given the uncertainty that renovation involves and the fact that a new structure would be both less expensive and address the deficiencies, the committee voted to go ahead with the new building. They're going to go to the Board of Selectmen on October 30th for a presentation. And at that time, they expect to have more firm cost estimates for new construction available. So we'll be reporting on that when it happens.
Tim, you have another story. You're covering some Chatham town officials went to Washington, D.C., and they're looking to resolve the long-running dispute over the Monomoy Refuge. Tell us what this is about.
Sure. This is a long time. It's been going on for more than a year now, where the town is trying to roll back the U.S. Fish and Wildlife's claim that about 3,000 acres of water and submerged lands in Nantucket Sound are under the jurisdiction of the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. The town and state say that's an illegal taking, and that the town and state have been managing and taking care of this area for literally for centuries. Now, this past Monday, Chatham Selectman Shireen Davis, Natural Resource Director Robert Duncanson, and Town Manager Jill Goldsmith met with Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish and Wildlife and Parks and the Senior Deputy Director of External and Government Affairs in Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke's office, and basically gave them a rundown on the history and talked about their concerns with this issue. Their aim is to try to get Zinke's office to adjust that boundary administratively by amending the management plan, which established this so-called illegal taking. Now the town is also pursuing other avenues to accomplish this goal, one of which is federal legislation that was filed by William Keating, which would roll that boundary back to the low water mark on the west side of Monomoy, which is where the town and state say it belongs. And they see the legislation route as the best solution because it would permanently establish the boundary at low water, while the management, the administrative change, if it was removed from the management plan, would take care of the problem for the short term. But when the next management plan is put together in about 15 years, it's possible that could be reinstated. So town officials are hoping to get that permanent fix in there. But the legislation has been stuck in the Natural Resources Committee of the House, and the town officials on Monday met with staff from that committee to try to get the ball rolling on that again. Now, the town officials say they didn't get any concrete assurances from their efforts in Washington Monday, but Shireen Davis told us that they felt positive about the meetings, and they plan to keep up the pressure to get this issue resolved.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
With me in the studio is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, in the Dennis Yarmouth School District, some very early discussions are underway about possibly combining two schools there.
Yeah, this would be the discussion is about combining the Mattakese Middle School in West Yarmouth and the Nathaniel H. Wixon Innovation School in South Dennis. And that's being considered as a solution to long-needed upgrades at both schools. Representatives from a Boston-based design and consulting firm, Perkins Eastman, discussed the possibilities on Wednesday.
And it looks as though combining the schools it's very early still in the process, but they're just...
Yeah, well, project managers will submit an assessment of the options and a preliminary design plan to the Massachusetts School Building Authority in November and decide by March which option to pursue. And one of the attractive things that they're saying is they'll save money by combining the two schools, because otherwise they'd have to renovate both aging schools. And there's discussion there could be like a site for the combined schools on Station Avenue near where the regional high school already exists and the school administration offices exist. There's also discussion of, oh, we'll put this at the Manatee site or the Wixon site. And so all these options are up in the air, but it sounds as though the project consultants consider combining the two schools an attractive option.
I want to circle back a little bit to the opioid stories that we were talking about earlier. Casey Myers had another article this week about Patrick Kennedy II, who is one of Ted Kennedy's sons, speaking out about this being a make-or-break moment in the opioid crisis, and really speaking about the need for more health care solutions, I think.
Yeah, this is Patrick Kennedy II, who is the former congressman from Rhode Island, and he's the younger son of the late Senator Edward Ted Kennedy, is one of six members of the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. Now, he is planning to present recommendations early next month to President Donald Trump about how to fight addiction. And this issue is very personal to him, as well as being of huge national importance, because as he wrote in his 2015 memoir, A Common Struggle, he spent much of his life contending with bipolar disorder and alcohol and opioid addiction. And he also said that he was talking about the role of alcoholism in his family. He said alcoholism is said to run in families. He said it galloped through mine. And so he's been very open and honest in talking about this stuff, which isn't appreciated by all family members. But he feels there really needs to be a, you know, discussion going on nationally and on the personal family level about the burden of addiction.
And as we were talking about opioid epidemic off air, you were telling me about just the number of overdoses who are touching personally people in the newsroom, even where you are.
Well, it's interesting because a reporter who sits next to me and I have both called police after witnessing overdoses, and the police confirmed that they were overdoses.
So coming upon somebody that you suspect is overdosed.
Yeah, in one case it was by the golf club in Hyannis where a car had gone perpendicularly across the road and there was someone slumped behind the wheel. It was really scary to see him not responding to knocks on the window, and another man was like, you know, just we were calling the police. I called the police. When the police got there, the police officer pounded on the window, could not raise the man, and then he used a tool to break the window, and then the man woke up, and he was promptly arrested. And then another time I was right in a neighborhood where I used to live in Sandwich, and was a young woman, and she had vomited outside her car, and she said she was fine, that she had just taken a new medication. But again, a neighbor and I called the police, and it was she was actually having, you know, a reaction to an opioid overdose.
This is an epidemic, and it's you can see how many different agencies are working to try to provide support networks for dealing with this.
Yeah, and the police are, besides arresting the dealers, they're providing rides to support groups in some towns. They are, you know, reaching out to family members after an overdose and talking to them about, you know, coaching through overdoses and the services that are available, because they say, yeah, they can't, you know, arrest their way out of this. Although, as the Deputy Police Chief Steve Exaros from Yarmouth said, you know, it's still important to make arrests and get these big dealers off the street.
Yeah, enforcement is still one piece of the whole picture there.
Right.
There is going to be a forum on the Cape on policing and communities, looking to build relationships between police and communities. And it has a special guest there coming too to speak.
Yeah, this will take place October 28th at Cape Cod Community College, and it's sponsored by the Martin Luther King Action Team of the Nauset Interfaith Association and the Criminal Justice Department at Cape Cod Community College. The featured speaker will be George Kelling. He launched a revolution in community policing with his Broken Windows article in the Atlantic Monthly in 1982. And that was the theory that if you take care of the small crimes that communities, you know, someone puts, you know, whatever, a baseball or a rock through a window, then that serious criminal activity will go down.
The idea to bring together communities and policing to talk about some of the issues that are such tension points between them, I think it's a great idea. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Yeah, the Reverend Wesley Williams, who's chair of the Martin Luther King Action Team, says he wants the different communities to talk to each other. He says, you know, they want to hear how the people from Chatham and Osterville have different views of the police from people in Hyannis and Mashpee. Now, that Broken Windows initiative did get some backlash when it was criticized for overzealous policies such as patting and frisking, which are seen as racist policies. So there was some backlash toward that. But overall, the broken windows concept of community policing has generated a lot of interest, a lot of police departments see a lot of results.
Hmm. We're going to go to Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Ed Miller, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good morning, Steve.
Ed, Provincetown appears to be looking to secure another first for itself. It may become the first town on Cape Cod to have a funicular. You'd better explain this for us.
That's exactly right, Steve. Last week was Women's Week in Provincetown, and it's always a big week in town. And David Widener, who's the director of the Pilgrim Monument and Provincetown Museum, hosted a talk, and he expected about 30 people. Instead, 130 showed up, and they had to move it outside. But the thing that people complained about to him was the climb up High Pole Hill in Provincetown, which is the highest hill in town, and on top of which is the Provincetown Museum and the Pilgrim Monument. And as a result, Widener revealed that he and his board have been talking about installing a funicular, which is a cabin, basically, an enclosed cabin on a narrow track that would ride up the hill from the base where there's a park, the Bas-Relief Park, right near the center of town, up to the top of the hill, and would enable people to get much more easily from town up to the monument. And they're very excited about this. There's still a lot of work to be done to see exactly how it would work and how much it would cost. They're thinking somewhere between $3 and $5 million, I think. But it's an exciting idea, and Widener says that he thinks it's going to be really awesome.
So the 400th anniversary is coming up of the Pilgrims Landing. I guess that's 2020. Was this something that could be put together in conjunction with that?
That's what they're hoping. There's going to be a series of community meetings to talk about it, but their plan is to try and begin construction next year in 2018 and have it ready for spring of 2019, well before the 2020 400th anniversary celebrations.
All right. Well, we will be following that story.
Should be a fun ride.
The town, I want to go to another story you have about the town parking lot at Cahoon Hollow Beach. It kind of collapsed during a big rain over the summer. There's been a lot of discussion over what to do about this, and the new proposal was put forward this week.
That's right. So in Wellfleet, there are four ocean beaches that are managed by the town, and the most popular of the four, everyone agrees, is the one at Cahoon Hollow Beach, and that is largely because of the Beachcomber restaurant and bar, which is there. And at the last Wellfleet Selectmen's meeting, there was a discussion of what to do about the fact that the parking lot, town-managed parking lot there, basically collapsed during a torrential rainstorm in late August, about a week before Labor Day, and it had to be closed completely. It's important to maintain access to the beach, of course, but the cost of repairing this parking lot, which periodically is washed out, and on top of that is eroding because of the Atlantic Ocean action at a fairly rapid rate. And Selectman Jerry Houck said he wondered whether it really made sense for the town to spend as much as perhaps $1 million to repair this parking lot when we don't know how long it's really going to be there. Mm-hmm. And he raised the idea that perhaps the Beachcomber ought to somehow be involved in paying for repairing the lot. And at that point, Dennis Murphy, who's the chairman of the Board of Selectmen, revealed that, yes, in fact, he had been talking to some other town officials about the idea of leasing the lot to the beachcomber and having them pay to repair it. After we went to press, I actually was able to reach Todd Labarte, who is the owner of the beachcomber, and he told me that nobody had actually talked to him about this recently, although it had come up in the past, and he said he was certainly willing to consider the idea. So that is another story that will have to continue in the future.
So the town gets revenue from the parking that happens there. If they lease it to the beachcomber, it would have to be something that the town feels is worthwhile, as well as taking into account that so much work has to be done to repair this.
Yeah, well, it's true. The town does get revenue. The Cahoon Hollow lot is one of two on the ocean side where people can just, they don't have to have a town sticker. They can just pay a daily fee, currently $20. But it's such a small lot, and only, it's been, as I said, eroding over the years. It's down to about 35 spaces, I believe. And Suzanne Thomas, who runs the beach program, said that this past summer, the town took in a little under $25,000 at Cahoon Hollow, but that it cost about $70,000 to manage the beach program there. So it's actually a losing proposition in terms of revenue at the moment.
Hmm. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, Cindy will be with us, and in the next segment, we'll hear from Mike Roush at the Bourne Enterprise. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, the town of Truro has received some land from the state, which it's going to use to provide affordable housing.
Yeah, this was just such a gift from the State Department of Transportation. It handed 4 acres of an old highway cloverleaf to Truro for this affordable housing. Now, the Truro town officials started initiating talks about this parcel 2 years ago after Governor Baker's administration announced that they intended to use state property for housing and economic development. Now, this is the town will use a $7,500 grant from the Massachusetts Housing Partnership to hire an engineer to figure out how to develop the site. They could have housing that possibly hold up to 16 bedrooms.
Mm. And I guess this spot is in a pretty good location in terms of being located, near Route 6 and along Route 6.
Yeah, it's a 3.91-acre parcel. And it's near North Truro Village, and it's part of a larger parcel that was reserved for a Route 6 on-off ramp that was never built. Now, Truro Selectman Jake Coburn says it's a big deal for the town not to have to cover land costs, since there will be considerable infrastructure costs associated with bringing water and wastewater treatment to the new housing. A ceremonial signing of the deed was scheduled to be held this week.
It was actually signed yesterday.
Yesterday, right.
Yes,
yesterday.
That's right. Let's talk about Yarmouth, which is looking to become an officially designated green community, and this would allow it to get more funding for energy projects from the state.
Yeah, as our headline said, Yarmouth is eyeing the green and conservation. They're pursuing this initiative to make the town eligible for grants to help pay for future green energy projects. If Yarmouth gets this green communities designation, it would automatically be eligible for an $180,000 grant and grants of up to $250,000 each in the subsequent years. That's according to town administrator Daniel Napick. And that would include lighting upgrades and energy efficient heating systems.
And so there's questions about they have to adjust the code, the building code, I guess, in order to accommodate this.
Yeah, there's several criteria, and they've met some of them already. For instance, Yarmouth has to come up with a energy reduction plan, and they've already zoned some. One of the issues was they have to zone areas in town to allow for a generation of renewable energy, and Yarmouth has already done that. Now, last year, the Department of Energy Resources gave out more than $20 million to communities for green energy projects. There are 185 green communities in the state and 6 on the Cape and Islands.
Well, it's the direction you can see where things are going, so it makes sense that they want to get some of the funding that goes along with that right now.
And for the state to encourage that.
Mike Roush of the Bourne Enterprise joins us this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, Steve.
Mike, the town of Bourne is getting a $1.5 million grant to help their effort to build a wastewater facility, but it's a wastewater facility, it seems, that could have quite a large impact.
That's correct. They're looking at building a wastewater treatment plant in Buzzards Bay. They have a longstanding agreement with Wareham to send 200,000 gallons of wastewater a day to their treatment facility, but the town has butted right up against that allotment. So there's no development that can take place. With the new treatment plant, they can increase that capacity by 100,000 gallons a day.
Mm. So right now there's a constriction on development of almost any kind, right? Because there's no place for the wastewater to go until they build this.
Exactly, exactly.
Tell us about the grant that they got.
It's a Mass Works grant, a state grant, $1.5 million. It's part of a $500 million grant that that the state is making available to cities and towns around the state. Yeah, they've been working on this for about 3.5 years now.
Mm. And it's only a piece of the puzzle of what this wastewater facility is projected to cost.
That's correct. They also have an application in with the federal government for an Economic Development Authority grant for $2.6 million. Right now, they also have $335,000 that the town has allocated to the project. So they're hoping to bring this down to about $2.5 million, which they feel could then be covered by sewer user fees.
So there might be an increase to the tax base even as they were able to provide more area for development here with this.
There could be if they don't secure the federal grant, but they're pretty confident that that's going to come through.
Mike Roush from the Bourne Enterprise. Mike, thanks for joining us and updating us on that story.
Thanks, Steve.
Cindy McCormick is with me from the Cape Cod Times. And Cindy, I want to talk about another Bourne story here, which is Stop and Shop owns a parcel of land in Bourne that they have been holding for a while and trying to look at what to do with. It's been a hard sell. Town feels like it needs more supermarkets, but I guess Bourne, they're not quite sure how to develop this parcel.
Yeah, our reporter Ethan Genter did a story looking at what's happening with this situation because Bourne residents, yeah, they want to know when and if ever and Stop and Shop will develop this 153-acre parcel near the Bourne Rotary known as Canalside Commons. This summer, Stop and Shop, which owns the parcel, requested and got a 5-year extension of something called a Development of Regional Impact Permit from the Cape Cod Commission. The permit was set to expire in July, and every large-scale project on the Cape has to go through this DRI process with the commission to determine how development will affect the area. So this has given them 5 more years to kind of, you know, see what they want to do with it. And so far, there's been no development. Over the past decade, ideas have ranged from a water park to retail complex with a restaurant and housing. Stop and Shop officials have said that so far developers have shown insufficient interest. Bourne town planner Corrine Moore said they've had people kicking the tires, but nothing concrete.
I guess there's some question about the traffic impact on this, of whatever would go on
right,
this parcel.
Yeah, the traffic flow, how it will go, because it's near the Bourne Rotary, how this will spill into the Rotary and, you know, what roads will go onto it. That's one of the big issues. Another big issue is that some residents feel they just don't trust Stop and Shop because Stop and Shop has held the lease on the old Grand Union location on Clay Pond Road and then has just sat vacant for years. And Bourne is sort of a town that's split in two and it just has one grocery store, and a lot of people do. They're like, we want this other grocery store. You're a grocery store giant.
why don't you
develop this? As a matter of fact, the planning board gave its approval to the permit extension, but it also wrote a letter saying that residents feel the grocery giant had been, quote, deficient in its social responsibility to share development plans with the public.
And so the town wants to stay in touch with Stop and Shop and over the next 5 years. What do they want to do?
Well, they want to meet with the Stop and Shop has agreed to meet with town officials quarterly to discuss plans and progress. And one of the topics of discussion is they might go for several smaller developments instead of one big one like a water park or something like that.
Another story we're looking at, the Steamship Authority this week took a step that it hopes will address the complaints of residents in Falmouth and Woods Hole. This has to do with big trucks coming through in the very, very early morning.
Yeah, I guess your crew here must hear them going
we
through.
We are aware of this, yes.
Early morning. Yet that the Steamship Authority voted Tuesday to ban large trucks from the early morning run from the Woods Hole Terminal to Martha's Vineyard that's starting next summer. Trucks 40 feet and over will not be allowed to board that 5:30 a.m. freight ferry. And this, the Woods Hole and Nantucket Martha's Vineyard Steamship Authority officials expect the move will reduce the noise from this truck traffic on Woods Hole Road and also from the ferry terminal very first thing in the morning. The freight ferry could carry, more smaller trucks as a result, but it will be, absolutely less than the number of big trucks grinding gears as they go down the road.
The board was also considering putting an additional fee on trucks to try to get them to shift how they were using the ferry service.
Yeah, they decided to nix these discounts for the smaller trucks. That would take about $20 to $105 off off the rate. And they decided to just go for the ban entirely. And they will be adding a freight boat Sankaty to the summer schedule, starting with a 6:45 a.m. trip to Vineyard Haven. That's designated for trucks bringing hazardous materials onto the island. This early morning freight boat has been controversial because Woods Hole residents have been complaining for a long time about the noise and pollution.
And the Steamship Authority has made some efforts to address these complaints.
Yeah. They've already said, very past regulations or policies, no idling, and they've designed the traffic flow so the trucks don't have to use their backup alarms. But they say they can't drop this 5:30 freight run entirely in the summer. It's way too busy. They have to get things to the island. The summer schedule for the ferry starts June 16th for the freight ferry.
Orleans town meeting voters approved money needed to go ahead with a project to sewer the downtown, but there are still unresolved questions about this sewer system.
Yeah, the Orleans town meeting approved it was nearly $4 million, that's $3.7 million for the sewer project Monday. And that will, and the vote was pretty overwhelming, 413 to 120. And it will need the approval at the ballot box, though. It's a Proposition 2.5 debt exclusion, and that will be at a special town election October 24th. Now, one of the concerns is Selectman Mark Matheson has concerns that there is no effluent disposal area has been selected. He said that he can't support putting the pipes underground without knowing what's going to happen to the waste. And the idea is they're going to put these sewers under Main Street and parts of Route 28 and 6A.
But I guess they feel like they have to move forward because if they're just sort of waiting to try to decide what to do, they're going to miss an opportunity here.
Yeah, they want to do this before a state construction project installs storm drains, new traffic lights, and other improvements in the area. Because if the town does not approve these sewers, it could suffer from a mandatory 5-year moratorium on construction projects on roads where state projects have recently been completed. And these delays could cost the town nearly $3 million in increased construction costs and the cost of ripping up the roads and sidewalks again and when they eventually do put in sewers. So there is a time element here.
Okay. Let's look at the story about a bike trail, a proposed bike trail to reach the beach in Brewster. There's some momentum from the state behind this, but the neighbors have some questions about what it could mean for them.
Yeah, state officials Wednesday unveiled a plan to build a bicycle trail that would start at Nickerson State Park and go to a small beach on Cape Cod Bay by Linnell Landing Road. And this is a 10-foot-wide multi-use trail, and you could use for bicyclists and pedestrians. The path would cross Route 6A, where pedestrians and bicyclists they'd stop traffic, that's the plan, by pushing a button for an over-the-road traffic light that would be installed as part of this project. Now, some residents said, hey, we want to know if a tunnel could be built under Route 6A rather than having this traffic light.
So that's So that's one more thing they're looking at, but it seems like it's pretty early. They're trying to put the pieces together on this.
Yes. Yeah. The next step is to have officials finalize the plans, return to town in January for more input and permitting. The project is expected to cost $1 million. One of the problems they said with this tunnel is that they'd have to do a lot of grading to make it handicap accessible. And that would really increase the cost.
Yes, that would increase the cost.
And it's interesting. The selection of this beach is in part to direct beachgoers away from eroded shores on the west end and shift them east where there's less erosion going on.
And let's look at it. You had a story this week about snowbirds. There are more than a few snowbirds on the Cape and Islands, folks who head somewhere warm as the winter comes on. You've got an article looking at folks who lost their winter homes or had them damaged from recent hurricanes.
Yeah, Sean Driscoll did a story about the snowbirds who, you know, escaped that the dreary winter weather by going to Puerto Rico, you know, other parts of the Caribbean, Florida. And what he's finding is some people are planning on returning. And there's one couple who they've been wintering in a small city in the northeast coast of Puerto Rico, and they know that their two-bedroom condo on the 14th floor has been damaged pretty heavily with water. And they also know that this is a 21-story high-rise, and they know that one of their neighbors there has been using the stairs because there's no electricity yet. So they really do plan on going back, but they said not till there's electricity. And they, of course, they need water and cell phone service too.
In a high rise like that, they're using the stairs.
Yeah. Can you imagine? And there's all these things people do to, like, they have to go to a certain location to get, you know, cell service, but then they're afraid to drive too far because they're using up the gas, because that's another difficult thing to get. And when you're talking about snowbirds, you're also talking about working people too, because one woman said, who has a boyfriend from her boyfriend was lived on West Dennis, and she's originally from Minnesota, but she was planning, she works as a bartender in the Keys, but their home there, they have was destroyed by the hurricane, so they just don't have. And she said so much of the housing there was destroyed, and the motel rooms were destroyed, and so she's staying in another part of Florida for a while, but she's sort of heartbroken that she can't go back to this place that she and her boyfriend love so much, and where she actually, you know, earns a living too.
A lot of disruption, from the storms this season. Before we go, I want to talk about a story, a sizable stranding incident this week involving dolphins. So mysterious when this happens. Rescue workers really scrambling to try to help the animals.
Yep, 14 common dolphins stranded in the Wellfleet Flats Wednesday afternoon. The International Fund for Animal Welfare was able to rescue 12 and release them to Herring Cove in Provincetown that evening, but two of the dolphins died. And what happened was they were stranded in the shallows by the Chiquesset Neck Road Dike when the tide went out. And it was, some observers said it was terrible. See them thrashing, hear them vocalizing. This included a group of juveniles and adults. And, you know, IFAW came in with their red mats, and they put the animals on the mats, and then they have these big wheel trolleys, and they take them to these specially equipped medical trailers, or, like, they're really animal ambulances, and with all kinds of equipment. And, and so they took them in just sort of convoys out to Herring Cove, and IFAW spokeswoman Carrie Brannon said, luckily it was a warm, calm night and the release went very well.
That's good to hear. What else? Anything else there?
Well, Carrie said this is the biggest cetacean stranding season for IFAW so far. She said her organization has already responded to 113 live dolphins and whales. Now, the common dolphins are often seen traveling through Cape Cod Bay, and they can reach 8.5 feet and 300 pounds. And like all dolphins, they look adorable, and we have a lot of pictures and video of them being rescued.
You have some great pictures from that rescue yesterday, and the effort of folks pulling together to get those dolphins off the beach and into the trailers and then released again.
Right. Yeah, it's a huge effort because they have to wade through this muck, and it's heavy work. And it takes a really big, well-coordinated team effort.
Those dolphins look very, when they're on the mat like that, they look so helpless. You realize that they're not going to survive if folks don't step up and intervene.
Right, exactly.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Cindy McCormick, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
And Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joined us. Ed Miller, we heard from the Provincetown Banner. And we spoke to Mike Roush at the Bourne Enterprise. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.